This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
It seems though it's happening more often. A pet parent comes to me with their furry kid in tow for a well pet exam. Their pet is feeling just great. Eating well, good skin, coat, no coughing, sneezing, vomiting, or diarrhea. It may be on the physical exam or routine lab work that I discovered the pet has cancer. It's one of the hardest conversations I can have. They know I must be wrong. How could their healthy pet have a potentially life-threatening disease? I have the impression I'm having this dialogue much more often than when I started practice. My questions: is cancer really occurring more often in pets? Is it more common? And if it is, what's the cause? And is there anything we can do to decrease the chances that our pets will be affected? My guest is Dr. Brennan McKenzie, a veterinarian and practitioner of evidence-based medicine. We'll tackle all these questions and more. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Today's episode is sponsored by Hanover Square Press and The Secret Language of Cats: How to Understand Your Cat for a Better, Happier Relationship by Suzanne Schatz. Have you ever wondered what your cat is saying? In The Secret Language of Cats, Schatz offers a crash course in cat phonics to help you crack the cat code. Perfect for the fans of The Lion in the Living Room and the inner life of animals, The Secret Language of Cats by Suzanne Schatz is available for purchase today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Dr. McKenzie, thank you very much. I've been reading your articles in some of our journals for quite a while now. Really enjoy them. So I know that you have a varied background in clinical practice, and I think a lot of people may be listening to this going, and what is science-based, evidence-based medicine? Could you define it for us?
Sure, happy to. Thanks for the opportunity. Evidence-based medicine is a concept that appeared in human medicine in the early 1990s and gradually became the dominant approach to clinical practice. It's taken a little while to catch on in veterinary medicine, but we're catching up. It's based on the idea that it is impossible for us as normal human beings, as veterinarians, to know everything that there is to know, and scientific knowledge is constantly changing and evolving. So in order to help our clients and pet parents make good decisions about the treatments that we recommend or offer, we need to be familiar with not only the diseases and the treatments that are available, but also with the scientific evidence about those things. And that, because it's constantly changing, is something that we need to have a structured way of keeping track of and working into our decision making. So evidence-based medicine is ultimately about finding an easy, convenient, efficient way for an ordinary practitioner to take the scientific literature and incorporate it into how they make decisions and how they make recommendations, so that what we ask of our clients and what we suggest to them is not only based on our own experiences or opinions or intuitions, but also based on good science and good data.
It's a constant battle for myself with all the journals that are available, the information on the internet from what I know are reputable sources, for me to stay abreast of. And I know when I finished veterinary school, I went to UC Davis. I'll always remember that as we're sitting there in the audience, you know, we're graduating, here's the dean comes up and says, all right, congratulations, you're now part of the profession. 50% of what we've taught you in 10 years is going to be false. It's up to you to keep track of which 50% is real and what is false. And it seems as though it's become logarithmic, where things are changing so radically that it's difficult for anyone to stay abreast. So yes, I think evidence-based medicine is great. It's hard.
It is a challenge for people in practice. We're all busy and not always able to get access to the latest and most accurate information. My focus is, as a practitioner, on how we can do that in a way that's efficient and easy for us. And there are some great resources out there. I was fortunate enough to be president for a short time of the Evidence-Based Veterinary Medicine Association, which is a group of both academic and private practice practitioners, as well as people from industry. And it was focused specifically on that issue. How do we make it easier for practitioners to find information so that they're up to date and to integrate that information into their clinical decision making? So there are a lot of tools out there for veterinarians. It is definitely a challenge for all of us and for our human counterparts as well.
Well, right now, the audience that's listening to us are those pet parents. And they're concerned that, yes, they want their veterinarian to be up to date. And as I said in that intro, when we find issues like cancer coming up, that is an area that's also changing so rapidly. I'd like to have you first define for the listeners. We toss around words like cancer and neoplasia, malignant and benign, but sometimes those are words that we know what they mean, but our listeners don't. Could you please break those down for us?
Sure. Our bodies are constantly repairing and rebuilding themselves. Our cells all through our body are capable of reproducing and replacing each other. And that's necessary. If you cut your finger, that wound is never going to heal unless you're able to make new cells and replacements and to heal. So that's a normal part of the function of our bodies. What can happen, unfortunately, is that that process can go awry. So the reproduction and production of new cells in the body can become uncontrolled. Instead of making just the right number of cells and just the right type of cells where you need them, the body may start making more cells than are needed, or cells that are in the wrong place, or that have a tendency to function abnormally. And in general terms, that's what we call neoplasia, a collection of cells that have reproduced inappropriately in the wrong place or in too great a number. Now, sometimes if we're fortunate, and often this is the case for our pets, those collections of cells don't do anything particularly harmful to the pet. So you may get a lump of fat under the skin, something we call a lipoma, and it's a little unsightly, but it doesn't hurt, it doesn't spread, it doesn't harm the animal at all. That's a benign neoplasia. That's a benign tumor or a collection of cells that are excessive and in a place they aren't supposed to be, but aren't doing any harm. And oftentimes, no treatment is needed for those, or if they become bothersome because of the way they look or where they're located, we can remove them, and that cures the problem. Unfortunately, sometimes those extra cells or inappropriate cells turn out to be harmful. Either they produce substances that interfere with the normal function of the body, or they grow so rapidly in such an uncontrolled way that they are painful, that they interfere with the normal function. And that's what we tend to think of as cancer. That's a kind of neoplasia that has the potential to be really harmful and that, unfortunately, we have to take action to try to control or treat.
That was awesome. Short, concise, very understandable. I can see why your clients like you so much. Looking at the number of cancers, I'm not sure if it's just because our pets are living longer and our clients are doing such a good job of being a team with their veterinarian to make sure that they're keeping their pets healthy, being proactive, but it seems as though cancer is becoming, the malignant type is becoming more common. Would you say that there are predisposing factors to this?
Well, I would say in the first place, it's difficult to know that. And that's frustrating that in human beings, we keep very close track of the kinds of cancer people develop and how many people develop them. And we have a good sense of whether or not individual cancers or cancer as a whole is more common over time or not. Actually, it seems from the best evidence we have in people that many cancers are becoming less common. The classic example is lung cancer, which is something that we can prevent by not smoking to a large extent, has become dramatically less common as people smoke less. Unfortunately, as veterinarians, we often don't have that kind of information. It's difficult to know for sure whether cancer is becoming more common in our patients or not. I will say that there are lots of predisposing factors to cancer, and it's frustrating as well for pet parents because we, of course, would like to know what the single cause is so that we can avoid that cause and make sure that cancer doesn't develop. But all of the things that control the reproduction of cells in our body so that they can do what they're supposed to do in healing wounds and in replacing worn-out parts are complicated and have many, many levels and steps. And there are many layers of protection to prevent those processes from getting out of hand. Our body goes through and identifies errors every time a cell is copied or reproduced and corrects those errors. Our immune system identifies cells that are reproducing inappropriately and destroys them for us before they become a cancer. So there are many, many layers at which that process is controlled. And that means that it takes a lot of different things to go wrong all at the same time for cancer to develop. Some of those things may be genetic. Our pets may be born with a tendency to make too many cells of one type or with a defect in one of the protective mechanisms of the body. Some of the risk factors may be environmental. As I mentioned, in humans, smoking is a classic example. Our pets may be exposed to things that increase the chances of a cancer developing. There are many different ways in which that system that protects us can go wrong. And
Dr. McKenzie,
yes.
I want to just kind of interject. You were talking about smoking and that smoking, yes, we know, causes cancer in people. But I was also reading someplace recently that people who smoke, if they have cats around in particular, they seem to be exquisitely sensitive and they can develop cancer from their owner's smoking.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, it's difficult. To say that cancer is caused by smoking is a little bit, it's a little bit off target.
All right.
It increases the risk. Obviously, there are people who can live 120 years and smoke every day and never get cancer. And sadly, there are people who do everything right and get it anyway. So I always try to emphasize with people, it's about things that increase or lower your risk. Because we have a tendency to feel bad if our pets develop cancer because we feel like there must be some specific cause. And if we had just done something differently, that wouldn't have happened. And that's not really how cancer works. To your specific question, you're absolutely right. The risk that smoking can cause, can increase in cancer development, it does affect our pets as well as it does us. And there's some evidence that it may even be more of an effect on our pets because they're smaller and the relative size of their lungs compared to their body is different. And they may actually absorb more of the cancer-causing compounds in cigarette smoke than the people doing the smoking. So secondhand smoke certainly is a risk factor for cancer in our pets. And as people smoke less, fortunately, that's less of a concern for our dogs and cats also.
Dr. McKenzie, on some of these risks, I know many of my clients are coming to me and they're now feeding grain-free because that's supposed to be much healthier. Or they're concerned about over-vaccinating their pets because vaccines are going to cause cancer. Or I'm recommending that we give certain medications to keep their pets free of internal parasites and things like heartworm, fleas. And they're really giving me some major pushback that, oh no, doc, I can't do this because I don't want my pet to get cancer. Have you seen somewhat of a cause and effect of any of these factors and the prevalence of cancer?
For most of them, there really is no evidence that they significantly increase cancer risk. It's certainly clear that there's nothing about grains in foods, for example, that should be a risk factor for cancer. And most of the arguments made to push that case are based on sort of really tenuous connections in laboratory studies of rodents that do things that are quite different from what we're doing in feeding grains as part of a balanced pet food to our pets. Most of the time, unfortunately, the risks are, I think, exaggerated, primarily because if we can identify specific things that we're doing as risk, then we feel in control. We feel like we could change those things and prevent cancer. And it's difficult to say to an owner of a dog or a cat, I think that the benefits of these things outweigh the risks, but I can't promise you that there is absolutely no risk at all. That's unsettling for people. But we have to look at the evidence. And the evidence, generally speaking, doesn't support most of the concerns about parasite preventatives and about specific ingredients in the diet. Vaccines in general are very, very unlikely to be a factor in cancer, with one very small specific exception. A lot of people are familiar with what are called injection site sarcomas. They used to be called vaccine-associated sarcomas, but actually they can be triggered by a lot of other things. Cats do have, unfortunately, a tendency to develop a very aggressive kind of cancer in response to a wide variety of things that we may inject into them, as well as to wounds and other kinds of stimuli. We're aware of that. That's something that a lot of research has been done to help us understand, and we've made a lot of changes in how we vaccinate cats and in what we use in our vaccines to try to reduce that risk. But it is quite a small risk, and we must be aware of the fact that the benefits of those vaccines in most cases dramatically outweigh that small risk.
I'm so glad you brought that up because, yes, the vaccine-induced sarcomas are devastating. And I remember when I first got out of veterinary school that we were giving most vaccines in the scruff. And people who've had pets for any length of time probably remember veterinarian just kind of grabbing a scruff of skin in the neck area and popping the vaccines in that area and going, oh, you're on your way. And then we found these sarcomas, cancers, to be forming. And now veterinarians mostly are giving vaccines, certain vaccines in certain limbs, further down on the limb. And it sounds terrible, but if your pet were to develop one of these cancers, and they can be very aggressive, sometimes it will save your pet's life. You have the limb amputated, but the pet still will do fabulously afterwards. And you're right, the risks and the advantages, I've seen so fewer diseases such as the rabies and leukemia now that the vaccines are done so routinely. And thankfully, these diseases, cancers, when they do appear, are so infrequent. But whenever it's your pet, it's one pet too many. But they are saving lives, these vaccines.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we should take a break right now. Take a break for a few minutes. Come on back and let's talk about, how would you know if your pet has cancer? So we're chatting right now with Dr. Brennan McKenzie, veterinarian, who's very much into science-based medicine. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your Cat Tree Tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. McKenzie, I think it is so difficult for people to realize that a pet may have cancer because a lump and a bump could be nothing, as you're saying, other than a fat lump, or it could be something more serious. They want something concrete that they can put their hands on to say, this is or this isn't. But in general, what should people look for that may raise those red flags of the suspicion that their pet may be a victim of cancer?
I think pet owners are, certainly my clients, are very attentive to the well-being of their pets. The pet is an important part of their family and they interact with them regularly. And so I think they're in the best position to know when there's something that might be a concern and should be investigated. The most obvious things are disruptions in the normal everyday functioning or life of the pet. So if you have a dog who eats well and consistently and enthusiastically every day, and you're finding that their appetite is not as good as it used to be, not consistently, that could be a concern. Certainly, if you find that your pets are losing weight, that's often an early sign that they're not feeling well, and cancer is one of many potential causes for something like that. As we mentioned, lumps and bumps on the outside of the body are certainly something that we should take seriously and investigate, and your veterinarian will be in a good position to evaluate those and let you know whether there's something you should or shouldn't be concerned about. Most of the signs of cancer are very general and nonspecific, and it takes some special testing, things like x-rays and ultrasounds or blood testing, to find out if that's really the cause. So mostly I encourage people to just be aware of the general well-being of their pet, appetite, weight, abnormal things like vomiting and diarrhea, lumps that are new, especially those that are growing quickly, and just kind of keep a regular eye on all of those things.
Dr. McKenzie, I think some of the most frustrating cases are cats, because cats love to hide their signs of illness. I always tell my clients, if your cat doesn't feel good, what does it do? Sleep. And what does your cat do when it does feel good? Sleep. So sometimes knowing when there's something wrong, I think it is so important, especially for cats, to get those cats in at least once a year for a good wellness exam. There are things many times happening underneath that fur that they're just not aware of. So monitoring weight, checking, you know, what's going on internally with labs is always a good idea. The palpation, sometimes you can feel a lump or bump or something internally and then do further diagnostics. You're exactly right with this. I would love it if you could kind of break down maybe some of the most common cancers that we see in dogs to begin with.
Sure. Many of the common ones are external. And so, as we already mentioned, the lipoma is probably the most common benign tumor. So not a cancer, but something that grows inappropriately. There are a large number of different types of tumors that can grow on the outside of your dog. Probably the most common that is cancerous and that we have to take action for is something called a mast cell tumor. Mast cells are a normal part of the immune system. They're the cell that give you that itchy red bump when you get a mosquito bite. But if they overgrow inappropriately, they can form tumors that can be quite aggressive locally or even in some cases spread elsewhere in the body. Certain breeds are more prone to those. We think often of boxers, for example, but any dog can have them. And that's probably the most common external tumor that we see. There are a few others that we see. Melanomas, as in people, are actually a little less aggressive in dogs, but we do see those as well. So as we mentioned before, checking for lumps and bumps on the outside is important, and then evaluating those with your veterinarian to see if they might be cancerous. Unfortunately, a lot of the common cancers in dogs are internal, and those can be harder to detect because they don't usually show up as a lump or bump that you can feel. So you have to be looking at those things like appetite and weight and energy that we talked about. Probably the most common ones in dogs that we see are lymphoma, which is a kind of white blood cell cancer. Most cancers are a disease of older dogs, but I will say lymphoma is one of the few that can occur in somewhat younger animals as well. Sometimes you will feel large bumps or lymph nodes in different parts of the body, but oftentimes those are going to be internal and you may not know that they're there. And I think the other most common one that we see is something called hemangiosarcoma, which is unfortunately a very aggressive kind of cancer that often doesn't have any symptoms at all until it's reached a point where there's some internal bleeding, and then you may notice your dog feeling lethargic or having difficulty breathing. So that one can come on quite suddenly. There are many, many different kinds, but those are some of the more common.
Hemangiosarcoma, you're so correct. It's one of the most devastating ones because yesterday, Doc, the dog was feeling great. This morning, maybe a little bit lethargic. Now, late in the afternoon, it seems pale, it's having a hard time breathing. Its belly seems a little swollen. Brought in, we do our diagnostics, and we have free blood in the abdomen. And sadly, too commonly, it is this diagnosis. Sometimes surgery will help because it could be benign, but sadly it comes on way too often, too commonly. Golden retrievers seems to be the most common breed that I see coming in. One of the things I think that I love to is I'm about to do a rectal exam, and everyone's now kind of puckering up right now going, why are you doing that, doctor? Everything is fine back there. Dogs have anal glands, those scent glands, that sometimes when they get scared will be kind of like put a stinky smell all over your room or your car or wherever that pet just happened to be seated. And they can have issues with these cancerous masses that can form back there. And oftentimes you don't know until, sadly, you stick your finger in their bum. That's the only way you can tell and take a good feel around. So if your veterinarian is getting a bit fresh with your pet, there's a reason for it because there can be issues back there. And unless you look, you're not going to know. Dr. McKenzie, how about cats? You mentioned dogs, some of the common tumors, the lymphoma, the lipoma, the fat lump that can grow, but usually grows fairly slowly. Breast cancer, we know, happens in dogs too. But how about cats?
Well, the good news is that cats seem to be a little less susceptible to cancer than dogs. The evidence is, as I said, not as good as in people, but the numbers that we have are pretty consistent that cats are a little less likely to develop cancer. And that is good because, as you mentioned, it can be harder to tell that your cat's not feeling well. So sometimes we don't see things that do develop as early as we'd like. Again, external cancers, cats are prone to a few skin cancers. The most common that I see is in lightly colored or white cats. You will see something called a squamous cell carcinoma. It's a kind of skin cancer. Often it'll show up on their ears or on their nose. It's just like in people related to sun exposure, so more likely in outdoor cats. So we do see that. There are a few oral cancers. The squamous cell carcinoma is another one that can show up in the mouth, and so can something called melanoma. So sometimes if your cat's not eating well, if they seem to have pain in their mouth or they're drooling, those are reasons to have a good look in there and make sure that there's not some kind of a tumor or a growth. Internal cancers are also possible in cats. I think probably lymphoma is, again, the most common one that we see. It shows up a little differently than in dogs. Most commonly, it shows up in the intestines. And so often you may notice weight loss, vomiting, diarrhea. It's interesting because of the hairball phenomenon, our cats tend to vomit up bits of hair periodically as part of their normal grooming process. I think we're a little bit too casual sometimes about vomiting in cats. All cats may vomit occasionally, but if it's happening consistently and regularly, particularly if they're not big lumps of hair, you might want to have your veterinarian take a look at your cat, because lymphoma in the intestines is a fairly common disease, and oftentimes all we notice is a little increase in how often they're vomiting or perhaps that they're losing weight.
I'm so glad that you brought up the vomiting cat, because I know that one of the almost catch-all diagnoses that we'll many times have to give these cats that have some vomiting, maybe a little diarrhea that goes on, some weight loss, maybe just not looking thrifty after we do a workup and then do an ultrasound to look at the intestines, my ultrasonographer will say, you know, it looks like you probably have a cat with inflammatory bowel disease, which I tell people is similar to what people can have in Crohn's disease, and that can wax and wane. But cats are such unique little creatures that I always have to forewarn them, don't discount this. This really can be so serious, because we know that cats with inflammatory bowel disease, it's a tipping point where they can go from having just inflammation to now having lymphoma. And you never want your cat to do that tip. So if you have a kitty that's vomiting, definitely brush a lot, so even short hair cats, so you don't have to worry about them ingesting extra fur. But the most important thing is see your veterinarian, have it looked at to make sure it's not a condition that has to be controlled, that it's just a kitty that you think is vomiting. It can be more serious than that. With these various types of cancers, have you found that it seems to be more common in males or females in general?
You know, cancer obviously is a very general term, and every specific cancer has its own unique pattern of risks. There are certainly some gender or sex differences in that. The most obvious is in breast cancer or mammary cancer. That's one that occurs almost exclusively in female dogs or cats who haven't been spayed. One of the main reasons why people recommend spaying routinely, because it's a very common and a very serious disease. There are obviously cancers that can only occur in males or females. You know, testicular cancer or prostate cancer is only going to occur in males, of course. Overall, there does seem to be a slight tendency for more cancers to occur in females than in males, especially in dogs. I don't think we know enough to be sure in cats yet, but you have to look at the specifics. It turns out that when we study cancer in dogs, a lot of those cancers occurring in the females are breast cancer. And if you look at populations of dogs, for example, in Europe, where they're often not spayed, that becomes the most common or one of the most common types of cancer. But if you look at populations, say, in the United States, where we're more often spaying our female dogs, that type of cancer largely disappears. And then that difference between males and females becomes a lot harder to find. So like most things, unfortunately, the devil's in the details, and it's hard to make generalizations about cancer risk between males and females.
My clients are always asking, isn't there a blood test, doc, that we can do that will predict that a pet is going to be getting cancer or my pet does have cancer? They're always looking at some of these genetic tests that are now being promoted to pet owners, where they can take a little swab of the cheek lining, send those cells in, and they'll be able to say, oh, your pet has this genetic predisposition. What's your feeling knowing that you're so much into this evidence-based medicine? Is there evidence that those types of tests will help predict if your pet is going to develop cancer?
I would say that the bottom line for most cancer diagnostic tests like that is not ready for prime time. There are studies in laboratory animals and very few but some in dogs and cats suggesting that particular markers in the blood, for example, may indicate when a cancer is present. Certain genes may predispose to cancer development, and we're beginning to learn more and more about which genes those are and how much influence they have on the risk. But there really is a great deal that is still unknown about most of those tests. There are things that are definitely exciting and interesting and should be looked at on the research level and the universities, but they're not really things that I think the average pet owner is going to benefit from. I always have to point out, too, that there are actually some problems with using tests that we don't entirely understand to look for something like cancer. Most of your listeners may know that guidelines for testing a cancer in people, things like mammograms for women or something called PSA, which is a blood test for prostate cancer in men, have changed dramatically in the last few years. These are examples of tests where we're taking healthy people or people who don't have any signs of cancer and doing some kind of a test to see if maybe they have a hidden cancer somewhere. The idea being, if we find it, we might be able to treat it more effectively earlier. It turns out that if you test a lot of people who are healthy and well, oftentimes you'll get results that are not reliable, that you'll get positive test results even if there isn't any cancer there. That creates a lot of anxiety. Nobody wants to be told they have cancer, and it creates a lot of risk to people for having other tests done to confirm or rule out that cancer when it actually isn't necessary. So in human medicine, where there's more evidence, they've actually backed away from some of the screening of healthy animals. In veterinary medicine, where we know a lot less about these tests, I think probably the risks of doing that kind of testing outweigh the benefits. I think the best thing to do is, as we said earlier, to focus on the things that you can see, to make sure that your pet is examined by a veterinarian regularly so that they can do the kinds of exams that lead us to suspicions that make that kind of follow-up testing more reliable.
And it really seems as though it gets down to early detection. So getting that pet in again at least once a year for a wellness exam. If you have a senior pet, twice a year, because so much can change in such a short amount of time. And no matter what the process is that is throwing off that optimal health of your pet, if you address it early, it usually has a better outcome, it's less expensive to treat, and you're going to find that it's just a win-win situation for all involved. So again, there's my push for getting in for early detection, getting your pet in at least once a year for a good wellness exam. Dr. Brennan, with the desire to try to be as proactive as possible, yes, get your pet in, oftentimes people are saying, okay, is there a special diet that I can feed my pet? Should it be raw or homemade or these ketogenic diets that are out there or supplements? Is there something I can do? So what's your opinion, Dr. McKenzie?
Sure. I think the most important thing that pet owners can do is to focus on what we do know, to focus on things that we have good evidence for. There's overwhelming evidence in every species ever looked at, including dogs, not again, unfortunately, in cats. Sorry, cat owners, we don't do as much research as we should in cats. That being overweight is a risk factor for many diseases, including cancer. And so the most important thing that a pet owner can do to reduce the risk for their pet is to make sure that they stay a healthy weight, to feed them appropriate amounts of food and a good quality food so that they stay a healthy weight. Other things, obviously, there are some infectious diseases that can trigger cancer in humans. The excitement lately has been around the human papillomavirus. There's a vaccine for this virus now, and the virus causes almost all the cases of cervical cancer in women. So we may be able to dramatically reduce the risk of this cancer through vaccination. The same is true in some of our pets. In cats, for example, the feline leukemia vaccine, if your cat is potentially exposed to that virus, the virus can encourage the development of some kinds of cancer, and the vaccine can protect them against those. So following good, normal preventative health care and good husbandry is the most important thing you can do. Most of these other things, special ingredients in the diet, supplements, superfoods, things that you may hear about on the internet or in the media, are things for which there really is very little evidence. And there's not a reliable recommendation that we can make saying that these things will benefit your pet. Unfortunately, there's also not clear evidence for most of these things that they can't make things worse. We were surprised to find in some studies in humans that some antioxidants like vitamin E actually increased rather than decreased cancer risk in a few cases. So I'm always cautious about making dramatic changes in what you give your pet, how you feed them, or how you treat them when there's not enough evidence to be sure that we're doing the right thing there. I recommend my clients focus on things like good health care, regular visits, weight management. I think those are the things we know are the most useful in trying to prevent cancer.
Absolute fabulous words of wisdom, Dr. McKenzie. Thank you so much. This has really been, I think, going to be an eye-opener for so many of my listeners to realize, sadly, it could happen to any age. Cat, dog, male or female, most important thing, as you said, be proactive, good nutrition, don't let your pet get overweight. Have routine medical care, have that team with your veterinarian so you both know where you're coming from, what you're doing, what your hopes are for your pet. And when there's a question, ask somebody like Dr. McKenzie. So thank you so much for being a guest today.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You've been listening to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Please tune in again next week to hear about ways that you can keep your pet the healthiest possible. And if you have any questions, drop me a line and I'll gladly bring it up on air. So take care. Chat with you next week.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.